from Philadelphia.
My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bobby.
Through the grace of God, the 12 steps, and strong sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since June 2nd of 1988. And for that, I'm grateful. So are my neighbors.
For sure.
Like Bob said, this is my third visit. I was here in 12 years ago at the convention, and about 5 years ago at a group's anniversary. So I actually have family who lives in Frederick, not far from here. Actually, my cousin Terry's a judge over there. She happens to be friends with Jack, so it's always good to get down here. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to come down. It's always a privilege to participate in AA. I actually, this afternoon, I went out to Antietam and walked the battlefield, which was incredible. So now my face matches my tie. I should have put a little bit more SPF on it, but what are you going to do? So I actually have 9:15 for those clock watchers. I know we got to get to the dance on time, but 9:15 I have. We synchronize our watches. And so for the next hour and a half, I will tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But one other thing, sometimes when I go to these things, I get to meet other speakers that I've hung out with before, and that's always cool. But this is actually the first time four of the speakers so far that are actually friends of mine that I've known lots of years, like Michelle. I remember when Michelle got sober young, we did a lot of young people's. My friend Billy was here. He spoke on Friday morning. He had to leave. Billy and I go back almost 20 years. And so then I got to hang out with Edith from Omaha. And my sponsor's here also. And my sponsor, Dick, was on the committee for the very first state convention 40-some years ago. So, and I'm always amazed, all those people who stood up in their 40s. I mean, for me to meet people who are sober longer than I'm alive, it's always a pleasure. Really, it's pretty neat. So here it is. It's still 9:45. All right. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar, very ethnic neighborhood in Philadelphia. I got 7 brothers and sisters. We had no booze in the house. I never felt a part of. We lived in a small 3-bedroom row home. And my father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. My mother suffered from a long history of mental illness and abused prescription medication. And because my father did not drink, he was smart enough not to have any booze in the house. My grandparents lived around the corner from us. These were my dad's parents. And their basement was finished as a bar, and that's where I had my very first drink. I forget how old I was, but I remember what it was. It was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father. And Ballantine had this old scoreboard in right center field, like with the 3 rings. And I was running around the basement bar, polishing off the half empties, or the half fulls, it depends on your perception. And my uncles pointed at me and said, look at him, look at Bobby. And that's what I craved. I never felt a part of. And that's pretty tough to do when you have 10 people living in a small 3-bedroom row home, but I never felt a part of. So like I said, besides my mother's mental illness, my mother was also pregnant for 10.5 years. She was. I have a sister who's 11 months older than me. I am 11 months older than my next sister. There's 8 of us in a 10.5 year span. Irish octuplets. So when I was in my, and I loved my grandparents. Both sets of my grandparents were immigrants, but my dad's parents lived around the corner from us. And that's where all the family functions were held. My father is one of 12, my mother from a much smaller family, she's one of 11. And so there was always a party. There was always a christening, a communion, a graduation. And I loved the music and everything that came. And there wasn't any insanity there. There was just drinking and, all that good stuff. And I couldn't wait to get older to participate in that stuff, But on Thanksgiving, I was always at the card table with my brothers and sisters. But I couldn't wait to get older so I could partake in the festivities there. Now, the kids from the neighborhood used to make fun of my grandparents because my grandparents being immigrants, so they used to speak kind of funny. And I don't know why they made fun of them, because if you come to the neighborhood, you may think that they speak kind of funny. But I didn't have the courage to say anything. I was afraid. It's amazing. I always had this dilemma. I thought I was a tough guy, but I was consumed by fear. And I would always get these positions that would put me in some sort of authority, and fear just consumed my life, even into early recovery. But I really loved my grandparents. And like I said, I didn't get drunk the first time, but it was the attention that I got from my uncles. My drinking really took off in high school. My parents, being children of immigrants, they knew the only way to make it in this country is by education. And so my parents made a great deal of sacrifice to send my brothers and sisters to private school. And I wanted to go to the local diocesan school with the kids in the neighborhood. You know, I wanted to hang on the corner with the guys. But my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. And right away I felt kind of different, because most of the kids who went to this school were from affluent families from the suburbs. Just me and a couple of the dirtballs in the neighborhood went to this school. And we had a reputation because we used to walk to this school. This school's like in the inner city. It's up on the corner 17th and Gerrata in North Philadelphia. And a lot of these kids, it was their first introduction to the inner city. So as they were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. Now, I knew that was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me, by the nonce as a kid, and by my parents, but the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. And I had a lot of nicknames, and one of the nicknames was Crazy Coil. And I did things that, my God, I knew was wrong. I felt uncomfortable doing it, but you came to expect it, and I certainly didn't want to disappoint you. And there was about eight of us from my neighborhood through these 4 years of school. So again, they were scared of us. You know, we thought we were tough guys and gangsters. We were idiots. That's what we were. But we did things like this. We saw football pools, and if you hit, we didn't pay off. What were you going to do? And they came back and they kept buying them off us. If you want to buy a particular substance, we would sell you a substitute substance. You know? And they kept coming back. We went through more oregano than a pizzeria. So, I remember my freshman year was football season, and I didn't play football, but we rented a bus, and we went. There was an away game, and there was drinking, there was fighting, there was police activity. It was really a lot of fun. And I remember the first day back to school, we all had to go see the disciplinarian. And he had about 10 of us lined up outside his office. And they were all upper class, and it was just me and another kid from the neighborhood. We're the only two freshmen. And I remember he makes a beeline. He comes right up to us. He said, "What's with you guys? You guys here like 2 weeks and you're getting this jackpot already?" And I just shrugged my shoulders. I said, "You know, Father, it's just one of them things." And what it was, it would be the story for the next 15 years of my life. You know, I didn't play football, so I didn't hang out with those kids. Even though I did well academically, I didn't hang out with the AP kids. They were just a little too weird for me. I was in new situations. I found out who the nitwits were, and that's who I would hang out with, you know. I didn't distinguish myself at the prep, but I didn't do badly either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. Wasn't making the dean's list, but wasn't failing out, you know. So the school, at the end of the day, these kids used to take public transportation to go home. Now, so the school, like I said, sits on the corner of 17th and Gerrard. 3 blocks away is the subway. And so, but 2 blocks away on the corner of 15th and Gerrard was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And when I was a junior, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple of different reasons. They had cold beer, they had dancers. But a lot of times I went there, me and the kids in the neighborhood, we would stroll out the street and go in the bar to show how tough we were to the kids from the suburbs. I'm not a tough guy, I never was. And every time I walked out that street and sat in that bar, I was terrified. But I got Crazy Coil, I couldn't let you know. Now you got to picture this, I'm 16, 17, I look like I'm 12. I mean, we got blazers, they know I go to school down the street. But they figured if we were crazy enough to go in the bar, they served us, you know. And it was just not, and as you can tell by the name of the establishment, I'm not from the neighborhood. I mean, we stalk out like store thumbs. But it was just crazy, you know. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education. And I knew I couldn't stay home because there'd be hell to catch. Because again, the sacrifice my parents made to send me to the school. And I don't like to catch hell. I love to create it, but I don't like to catch the ramifications of it. So my options are limited. Like, what am I going to do? You know, I'm 17, I got no money, I have no skills. So I'll go into service. That wasn't a bright move. I thought it was. The military wasn't popular then. There were still guys up in Canada. But I went through my training, and after that I got sent overseas for 13 months. And that's where my drinking really took off. I never messed around with all the substances. I never even smoked a joint. But I had a drinking problem before I went in. I was overseas a couple months, and several good friends of mine got killed. And I know how to handle that. Because in my family, we don't talk about nothing. You know, and once you moved out of the house, whether you went to get married or you went to school, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. Everything stayed within the walls of the house, and then if you lived in the house, everything stayed inside you. And that's not a shot at my folks, that's just the way it was. We don't talk about nothing. So when my friends got killed, I couldn't tell people what was going on, but booze numbed the pain, and that's what I did, I drank to numb the pain. And the same thing in the service, I didn't distinguish myself, but I didn't get in any jackpots either. Doing the bare minimum effort required to get by, you know. And when my tour was up, I came home, I enrolled in school, I went to St. Joe's, and it was a small school, I think back then, I don't think we had more than like 2,500, maybe 3,000 kids max, you know. And I wound up taking a couple civil service exams. And even in St. Joe's, there's about 15, 20 of us in the classroom. And the same thing, I'm not making the dean's list, but I'm not failing out either. Giving the bare minimum effort required to get by. And at the end of the spring semester, one of the kids from the neighborhood had called me up. He said, Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. One of those businessman specials, you know, like one of those midweek, mid-afternoon games. He said, you want to go? I said, sure. They're not going to miss me in the classroom. I'm not an active participant there. So I went to the Phillies game, and the Phillies have since moved. They're playing the Vet Stadium down in South Philadelphia, right? And I'm at the top of the 700 level drinking that cheap, watered-down beer. And it was an unusually warm day. It was in May, and the sun's beating down on me. I'm getting kind of trashed. And I told the guys I was with, I said, you know what? I said, I want to run down in the field and meet one of the players. And they said, okay. And they kind of shrugged me off because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I would tell people, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I didn't do nothing. I couldn't even get off the bar stool. I told stories. I lied about everything. I told you I should have started off once upon a time. I lied about everything. I lied when I was better suited to tell the truth. It was just nuts, but I lied about everything. So, but I worked my way down. They used to have these picnic areas in the right field and the left field and the right field corners. And I worked my way down to the one picnic areas, and I jump over the fence, and I'm running out in the field. I'm probably in center field before anybody knows what's going on. And the San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I go out, and I shake his hand, and I say, hey, Dave, how you doing? And he looked at me, and he said, brother, what are you doing out here? And he's a pretty big dude, but from behind him, I saw the guards coming. I said, Dave, I got to go now. And I start running towards the infield. I want to slide into second base. I don't know why. I just thought that'd be a pretty cool thing to do, you know? And I was running towards the infield, and there was more guards coming from the third base side. And I knew I couldn't do that, because if I slid into second, I'd get caught. So I turned around, I start walking, like slow trot, like walking towards first base, like to give myself up to the guard. And I was close, maybe about 10 feet away from the guard, right? I'm walking to give myself up. At the last second, I did the guy, and I ran out in the outfield. Now, I'm running around like a screwball. It seems like 10 minutes, right? But it's probably closer to 2 or 3. But the place is going nuts. I got these guards, these young, short, fat guys. I mean, they're tripping over each other. It looks like Keystone Cops. I mean, I'm just home from the service. I'm in good shape. I'm joking and jiving. And it's actually one of my highlights. It's really good. Well, you know what? I got nowhere to go. The fence is 12 feet high. I'm drunk. I'm out of breath. I'm about to get sick. But I got nowhere to go, so I just stop running. I wait for them to come catch me. And they come catch me, and they take me off the field, and I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. They take me up to the right field bullpen, and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies, and the Tugger gave me the thumbs up, you know? He was probably loaded too, you know? Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from these guards because I made them look so stupid. They could have beat on me all day long. I don't care. Because I actually pictured this. I said, you know what? By the time I get out of jail, I could be back in the neighborhood. I could drink for free off this story for at least a week. Now, this would be the type of story I'd make up. Bullshit Bob, right? But I had those four guys from the neighborhood, and I'm hoping after they bail me out, I'd be back in the neighborhood. I actually pictured walking into the bar with the shot glasses upside down in front of me. I'd be a legend. Just as I was about to get my beating, a Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, what's the matter with you? He said, are you drunk? Are you high? I said, no, I'm just happy. I'm just happy to be here. He said, well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium. So not only did he save me from getting a beating, which I kind of appreciated, but he also saved me from getting arrested, and that was important. Because about 6 weeks later, one of them civil service exams kind of panned out, and I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They were hiring anybody back then. Now, I got hired. I'm not even old enough to drink. The drinking age in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has always been 21. The drinking age in Jersey at that time was 18. And where I lived in Philly, I could be across the bridge in Jersey quicker than other parts of Philadelphia. But once I got on the job, we had a mayor at the time, a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. Frank was a former cop and police commissioner. He loved this. We could do no wrong. And I remember when he swore us in, we're holding our credentials up. He said, gentlemen, in your hand, you're holding the ticket to the best show in town. And he wasn't lying. I mean, we were 8,300 strong. We were like gangs with badges. It was just great. Now, I need to back up. That story I talk about running on the field, I tell that story for a couple of different reasons. One, it's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't an athlete, I wasn't a lover, I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent, drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody I came in contact with. I was a creep in all my affairs. I was just a creep. Secondly, it's a true story. I got those four guys from the neighborhood, they can back me up. And thirdly, you know, I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. I forgot a lot of things. I remember I would come up to the corner and the guys would be telling me stories of this behavior I engaged in the night before, and I would retell those stories a couple hours later like I had memory myself. I remember when I finally got sober, I was at the VA hospital and the doctor came up to me and said, listen, did you ever have any blackouts? I said, nope. I must have answered too quickly. He said, do you know what they are? I said, nope. Once he described them, I said, all the time. That's why I thought you had a good load. If you couldn't remember it, I thought that was like standard procedure. It was just nuts. So I graduate from the academy and I get put up in North Philadelphia. And I would spend the first part of my career up there. And at the end of the tour, I saw things on the job that bothered me. You know, I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. But I couldn't tell my coworkers that because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys. To the point where I engaged in behaviors and my God, I knew was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me, by the nuns as a kid, by the Jesuits, in the service, my parents, I mean, I knew better. But I didn't have the courage to do the right thing. I'm compromising my values and principles, and from the very first start, I compromised them. So, but what I would do, I would drink to numb the pain. My life was ugly, and it got ugly quickly for me. I remember at work one day, my immediate supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, you know what, kid? He said, you're smart, and you're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up, in one ear and out the other. I'm at a family function one time, and my uncle was there. My uncle was a boss on the job. He had pulled me off to the side. He said, Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot, in one ear and out the other. Several years later, on two separate occasions, I ran into my uncle and that supervisor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that they were trying to help me, trying to 12-step me. And I remember talking to my uncle Jimmy, I said, well, how come you didn't tell me? And, you know, he gave me one of them old-timer smiles and said, Bobby, you just weren't ready yet. Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I was 24 years old and I was involved in an incident in which a 15-year-old kid lost his life. And it was a terrible situation that could not be avoided, you know. The mental health professionals now have a phrase, suicide by police, but almost 30 years ago that wasn't around. And I used it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for my next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. Drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and one of those nevers was drinking on the job. I would never do this. Like, I was squared away. You did not want to cross my path. Like, I didn't get anybody breaks, you know. But I wound up getting promoted and transferred, and I'm doing this particular work, and so I thought that I needed a drink to maintain some sort of illusion. And then one night, I'm put in a position where I thought that I needed to get involved to do other substances. And because I'm drinking, my judgment was impaired. And I would never do this. Substance? No, that's they're junkies. I would never do that. And I got involved in other substances. My use of other substances is very short. It lasted 17 months. And out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's all I need to talk about that stuff. So please feel free. Use your imagination. Don't eat justice. Don't hold anything back. Just let it go. But it was ugly, you know. And my life was falling apart. I'm sitting home from work one day, and I'm reading the Daily News. There's an article. At the end of the article, there's a series of questions and the phone numbers. And the questions were alcohol problems, drug problems, marital problems, depression, thoughts of suicide. I was 4 out of 5. Because I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I would have been batting 1,000. And they talk about the moment of clarity. As soon as it came, it quickly left. But something made me cut that ad out, and I stuck it on my wall, and I continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. Guys that I worked with, we were in some trouble. We go to the bar, get our stories together. That was our purpose, to get the stories together. It just turned out to be another drinking, fiasco. And one of the guys I was with decided he needed to go home. God forbid, take care of some sort of family obligation. So he wants to go home. And I don't think that I was as drunk as he was, and I suggested I give him a ride home. I'd be his designated driver. And he thought that was a good idea, and believe me, it wasn't. I'm an arrogant guy. I would see things on television or the news or in the movies. I can do that, like things were caused. I said, man, I can do that. I now know all these things are prearranged on people and all this other stuff, but I'm going to show off my driving skills. Doesn't matter, the car I'm driving doesn't belong to me anyway. It's a city car. I've got nothing to lose, right? And I'm driving up this narrow one-way street, and there's a big stone wall on my left-hand side. It's about 10 to 12 feet high. And I'm riding down the street, and there's a kid riding towards me on a bicycle. And for some reason, I was going to play chicken with this kid. I was going to show off in front of my coworker. Because for some reason, I thought it'd be funny to see this kid jump the curb and grab the wall. Didn't know why that'd be funny, but I just thought it would be. And unfortunately, at the last second, we turned the same direction. I ran that kid over. As he lay bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car with my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was either going to milk me or the city for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw him on the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw it on the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, made some sort of smart aleck remark, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody helped me because I was such a creep. And believe me, I was a creep. In all areas of my life, I was a creep. And I didn't think anybody would help me. So what I decided to do, I got a case of beer, a bottle of liquor, and some other substances, and I checked into a hotel with the intentions to consume all this stuff to build up the courage to end my life. And 3 days later, the booze is gone, the other stuff is gone, they're knocking on the door to kick me out, And I don't know what to do, but I was just so tormented. So I walked over to the window, and I opened up the window. I was going to jump out the window to end my life. And when I opened up the window, I looked out. I remembered I was scared of heights. I was on the 5th floor. So what I did, I went in the bedroom, I filled the bathtub with water and had a blow dryer. I was going to pull the blow dryer into the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would pull the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was like about 1.5 feet short on cord. And I got 1 foot in the tub and I'm laying in trial, walking in. And it's okay to laugh, but I never want to forget the pain I was in that day. So the only other tool that I had left was my car. So I took one last spin to the neighborhood. And I went to see the corner hung on where I went to school. I don't know why, I guess I wanted to see these things one last time. And I start up the Falls Bridge and I come down East River Drive. And the East River Drive is the winding road along the Schuylkill River. And this was a midweek day, mid-morning. Because if this were any other time of day, I probably would have succeeded what I set out to do. Back then, I think the speed limit was 20 or 25, no more than 25 on the drive. And I'm cooked and I'm hungover. I'm coming down the drive and I'm doing about 50, 60 miles an hour. And my original intent was to go on oncoming traffic to end my life. I mean, I handle jobs like this head on collision at a certain rate of speed. That certainly does the trick. And then I had flashback on something that I experienced as a younger guy on the job. And if you would have asked me back then to list the top 50 things, this would never even made the list. I never gave it another thought, but I guess subconsciously it was always there, and I guess I was haunted by it without even knowing it. I was young. I was about 21, 22, and I knocked on this guy's door. I had to do a notification. And he answered the door, and everything's relative to me. He was an older guy. He was in his late 30s or early 40s. And I had to tell him that his son was killed in an automobile accident. And the only way, I can remember this as clear as a bell, just like yesterday. The guy slumped against the door of his house, and the only way I can describe it is I actually could see the life leave this guy's eyes, I was in court about 3-4 weeks later. I'm walking down the corridor. I didn't even recognize the guy. The guy stopped me, wanted to talk to me. He must have aged 20 years. As much pain that I was in that day, I could not inflict that type of damage on an innocent family. Now, believe me, that's not me, because I don't care about anybody. I now know that was the grace of God, but I did not know that day. But I, as I'm coming down the drive, I knew I couldn't do that, but I was still so tormented. I knew I needed that my pain. So I decided I would hit one of these trees, wrap myself around one of these trees. And I handle jobs like this. That does the trick. You know, if you hit the tree just about right, you can actually split the vehicle in half. And if you're not belted in, you get ejected and struck by another vehicle. That certainly would do the trick. And by then, I just lost it. I just started crying. And I'm surprised I didn't get in an accident by accident, because I had no control over my emotions whatsoever. And I pull at the end of East River Drive, it's Boathouse Row, and I pull up on the curb and I just sat behind the wheel of my car and I cried like a baby for about 3 or 4 minutes. And I reached in my glove box to get I always had a second gun, and you always needed one of those. But the gun wasn't there, but inside that glove box was my wallet. And inside that wallet was that article that I clipped out of Daily News about 6 weeks before. And this is no longer there, but outside the last boathouse is one of those old glass enclosed phone booths. And I walk over to the phone booth, and I had the article out, and I dialed the phone number. And the lady who answered the phone, I spoke to this lady like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. I told her everything that was going on in my sad, miserable life, and God bless her, she listened patiently. And when I got gone, she said, "Listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital? Somebody waiting to talk to you." I said, "Okay." So I got my car. It's about a 3 or 4 minute ride, tops. I go over to the hospital, they're waiting for me. They admit me to their 10th floor, their psychiatric unit. And they kept me there for about 3 or 4 days. It got me kind of stabilized. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And there I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville, where I would spend a few more weeks in their flight deck before I got put into the alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous is the furthest thing from my mind. I'm thinking, maybe I get this mental illness, I heard this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress stuff they're now talking about. I got this from the job, I got this experience in the service. Maybe it's the neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mummer. I don't know. But it can't be alcohol, because I'm a beer drinker, and there's no way you can be an alcoholic drinking beer. I mean, I knew what alcoholics were. Alcoholics were these poor people I was dealing with up in North Philly on a daily basis. I mean, I was a beer drinker. The only time I drank hard liquor was like on New Year's Day, or St. Patty's Day, or payday. But I was a beer drinker. You can't be an alcoholic drinking beer. It's just not. So, I go, after I get in Coatesville, the day I get put in the alcohol and drug ward, it's probably the first time in about 6 weeks that I'm in a place that has a handle on both sides of the door. And it's amazing how quickly arrogance comes back to a guy like me. So I got to scout the lay of the land. You got to check it out, right? And I wander into the day room, and in the day room, they got the large, actually not that large, but they had the big window. They are big, aren't they? They had the big window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I zip through the steps. I got about 6 of them done. I see the amends. They're screwed. We don't do that. Not my neighborhood. Amends? No, I don't think so. Sign of weakness. Well, what later that night came up, two men came up, and they were part of the treatment facility committee. I did not know that then. I would find out that later. And they came up to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I didn't like, didn't relate to, or didn't identify with, I'd immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. Now, I'm looking around the peers, my guys in the community, and I realized the decision to do something about my drinking is definitely premature. Because these guys, I mean, these were all older guys. I mean, they were like I said, 30s and 40s. I mean, I'm 27, you know. These guys had drug problems, you know. I don't like drug problems like that. I mean, I sure knew some other substances. That was really my problem. Maybe I have mental illness. I got that from my mother. Maybe it's the stress I got from the job, the service. I'm a mommer, the neighborhood I live in, you know. These guys who had wives who hated them, stay away orders, kids, support issues. I didn't have any of those issues. Probably due to the fact I'd never been married or had no children. These guys had employment issues. I've had no employment issues. I've gone from high school to the service to the city. I mean, I just celebrated 28 years of service with the city a couple of weeks ago. I'm looking for the differences and not the similarities. These guys had legal problems. I don't have any legal problems. Probably due to the fact because I had a gold shield in my back pocket. It's just nuts. But what bothered me the most, without any question, was at the end of the meeting when everyone got in a circle and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people about, I definitely didn't want nothing to do with you. Because I hated God. And I knew there are strong words, but it doesn't even begin to sum up the feelings I have towards God. I hate him for, believe me, for lots of reasons, and they're all legitimate. And one of the reasons I hated God, my mom had this mental illness, you know, and she was involved in the charismatic movement in church, you know, she could speak in tongues and all that stuff. And I'm 15 years old, I came home from school one day, and I'm in the house about 10, 15 minutes, and I had gone downstairs for some reason, I had come across my mother had slit her wrist. I remember she looked up at me, she said, Bobby, help me. I looked down at her and said, good for you. And I walked out of the house, and I got an older guy to go to the state store to get a bottle of wine. I drank the wine. I came home later that night. My father told me what happened. I acted surprised. I said, oh yeah, how about that? So that happened when I was 15. I got sober when I was 27, and that's 12 years of hating God, and that's a pretty good hate. And it'd be a few more years before I would even address this issue. So I'm not holding any hands, and I'm not saying prayers. But you know what? I couldn't even respect your right to pray. Because they did say, for those who care to join, but I guess I didn't hear that, didn't want to hear that. And I would kick the chair and make all sorts of noise and let you know that I was uncomfortable. When it came time to get out of the VA hospital, I'm about to say to some places not to get a lift, a nurse came up to me and she had to be a member of Al-Anon. She was just a beautiful lady and she saw all through my BS. And that's all it was. It was all facade to keep somebody at bay. And she said, the only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I got my recovery. I would get my recovery in AA. I didn't get it at the VA hospital. The VA hospital does great work. They drain the oil. They tighten the bolts. I mean, they hook me up. But I would get my recovery in AA. And I go to AA every set, 2, 3, 4 times a day. It doesn't matter. It depends when I'm working. I don't drink coffee. I've never had in my life, so I don't make it. It's the way I roll, you know. I don't smoke cigarettes. I've never had in my life. I don't empty any ashtrays. I know that's not an issue now. 23 years ago, I used to be a service physician. I'm not emptying the ashtrays. Walk into a big book meeting or step meeting, strictly by accident, I would leave at the break. I had something more important to do. Tradition meetings, absolutely not. Rules, my line of work, we like to enforce them. We don't like to file them. They're for other people. I'm interested in war stories. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't relate, didn't identify with, or didn't, you know, just didn't like, I would immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. But I was a meeting maker. I made meetings. Now, I need to tell you, my very first outside meeting that I made was, there was a husband and wife speaking. It was a group's anniversary, and they both had 10 years. The wife had one more day than her husband, and she constantly reminded him of that. And I said, 10 years? I don't think so. Maybe you go over in Jersey and drink and keep your Pennsylvania time. I don't know. But I just thought, I couldn't understand 10 years. But there was a guy from my neighborhood whose nickname was Troubles. That's a hard-earned nickname. You get a nickname like Troubles. And Troubles was sober a couple years. I had not seen him in a few years. I thought he was in jail. He was always in jail. Or I thought he may have been dead. And here he was in AA for a couple years. But because we're in different lines of work, I don't talk to him, of course. I just nod to him, you know, I'd give him a nod, and that was it. But I could not believe he was sober. I was more impressed with him than these people with 10 years, because this dude I knew. I said, wow, he's sober, you know. So I'm a meeting maker, make meetings all the time. I'm sitting in this bar one day, drinking soda, though, seltzer, that was okay. Drinking seltzer, and because this bar sold real good roast beef. It's like the best in the city. Now that's a lie. No, the roast beef is good, but the reason I was there, I was a lie. 23 years ago, I would have said I was there because real good roast beef. But the truth was, the reason I was there, I'm an arrogant guy. I'm getting a lot of attention on the job, I'm going places, getting promoted. But towards the end of my drinking, there's a lot of negative publicity. The reason I was in the bar that day, I said, man, mistaken identity. I don't know who that guy was. I'm back. Things were cool. That's why I was in the bar. The arrogance, it's amazing. A couple guys from the neighborhood, they come in, they decide to knock me down a couple pegs, and I understand where they're coming from because I'm an arrogant dude. And you know, they start like with the taunts, and the one guy just got a little too close to me, and I'm drinking seltzer out of a rock glass, and I stand up and I punch him in the face, and he drops, and I open him up, he bleeds like a pig. And the wagon crew comes in. I knew one of the guys on the wagon, and he had pulled me off to the side. He wanted to hear my version. I told him what had happened. I can still see the look of disgust in his eyes. He says, you know what? You're nuts. You better get the hell out of here. I mean, I could have got jammed up. That would have been a serious incident. But that's how nuts I am, you know? I'm sober a year. I tell my story, my home group at that time. That's what would happen. You would tell your story. And I got done. It was amazing. I got done speaking. The thunderous applause. The blind could see. The lame walked. It was truly miraculous. And the people came up and they patted me in the back saying, man, Bob, you're doing good. I lied during my entire story. I identified myself as an alcoholic because in my group you couldn't talk about that other stuff. And actually, that's what I thought my problem was. I thought, again, it was my short use of other substances. Maybe I got this mental illness. I got this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress from the job, from the service. Maybe it's a neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mommer. But it can't be alcohol. You know, it can't be. Actually, during the course of my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys didn't want to hear that. And because I didn't burn all my cells, I knew how to hold on to information and give it back to you. And I probably sounded like the second coming of Bill. And they pat him on the back and say, Bobby, you're doing so good. And I was dying inside. I was sober 23 months and beat another man with a baseball bat. Forget what step I was working that day. I did everything wrong you could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I didn't do, I didn't pick up a drink. I don't want to say I was the worst member of AA, because that's like bragging. But it wouldn't take long to call the roll. I mean, stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a liar, a thief, and a cheat. I was a creep with the new women. I did everything wrong. I used to go, my early recovery, my first couple years, I used to go like to a lot of gentlemen's clubs. But I drank soda, that was cool, right? I would get my picture taken, like with the entertainer. And I would come back to the meetings and paste the picture around to the old timers. I knew they would look like that. They would like that. I would give them the picture. They would look at the picture and they would look at me and they would just like close their eyes and shake their head and say, please, kid, please keep coming back. And I thought, that's all right, I'll keep coming back. I mean, I was just nuts. We had an anniversary board and I grew up first for the board, anniversaries for the month, right? First name, last initial, date of month, and how many years you're celebrating. If Joey A had 3 years and I had 2 years and Joey A went out, that's good. He's out. I'm in. Seniority. I'm in Philly's a union town. Seniority counts for a lot. I just not. I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I said, man, why are they blowing this guy's anonymity? You know, he's a pretty tough SOB. I wouldn't want to tangle with him. When I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid, but here I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. I was just nuts. You know, there's like a diner on every other corner, there's like a tap room on every corner, so at the end of the meeting, guys would go to the diner. And you would have to run over me to get out of the meeting. And people would come up to me, Bobby, we're going to the diner, you want to go? I said, nope. But God forbid you ever invite me. I was just nuts, you know. But as a meeting maker, and it was just crazy. It was my second anniversary came. I did not celebrate it. 1 month after my second anniversary, I want to eat my gun. Here I am, stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. And I don't know about you, but to be honest, I think I was in more pain on that day. Then I was actually on that last day in that hotel room. Because here I am, I'm standing in the middle of people living in the solution, and I just refused to take it. And I hated everybody, but you know what I hated the most? I hated the new people. People say they're the most important. No, they're not. I hate them. And I'll tell you why I hate them. Because at this point, I'm sober 2 years. And if you say you got 10, I said, okay, I know you're 2. You said you got 10, I'll spot the other 8. I'll let you go. But however, I'm 2 years sober. I see these lunatics come in behind me. I mean, they can't speak complete sentences. They stink. They're just nuts. I see these guys get better in front of my eyes. So I know it's working. But I hate them the most. And the reason they got better from before me, because they were willing to take some action that I didn't want to take. I'm in a meeting one weekend, Friday night. Man, no one's there. Like, the attendance is whacked in half. Same thing Saturday. I'm always a meeting maker. I said, man, where's everybody at? Sunday night, here they come. They were all away on retreat. And I need to tell you, the worst meeting to go to is Sunday night after the retreat. I mean, they all got the pink clouds double parked outside. They come floating at us. I got to listen to this. I never left the meeting. That's the only thing I think I did right in AA. But I would just sit there and so uncomfortable. That's the only time I would share. Serene people scared the hell out of me. You know, they said you can't miss what you never had. Well, I never had a peace of mind, so I never miss a damn thing. So when the meeting was real serene, then I get my hand up to set the room off. Then I felt more comfortable. So thank God it's nuts again. I'm in a meeting one night, and they come up to me and say, Bobby, are you working this weekend? And before I know it, I said, nope. And I knew that was the wrong answer. Now, at that time, my week was a six-day work week. We work 6 days and off two. I would get 7 weekends off a year. That's it. Like every seventh weekend, I would have a three-day weekend. And they said, good, we're going to go on a retreat this weekend, and we're going to take you with us. I said, ah. Now, I made fun of these guys, but the truth is, I knew I was safe with these guys. These guys extended the hand of AA out there, but even though I slapped it away, the harder I tried to push these guys away, the closer they wanted to get next to me. And they were good men. They really were. So on a Friday afternoon, they throw me in a back seat and the big guy on the inside of me. And it's like role reversal because at work I drive and you're in the back. But you know, it's just the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. Because I'm sober 2 years now in AA and I know that you could not get kicked out. But I'm also sober long enough in AA to know that not everyone is always greeted as warmly as the next person for one reason or the other. I'm not judging, just my experience, that's what I've seen. There is no way I can tell these guys about the experience with my mom and why I hate God. I just couldn't do it. But and the closer we got to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. But you know what? There was also a part of me knew that I was safe with these guys. I mean, I got this internal struggle, battle going on. We get there, it's on Friday afternoon, it's like 4:30, 5 o'clock. They say, Bobby, we want to introduce you to the retreat master. I said, oh, come on, let's get this over with. They take me down this long carpeted hallway, they knock on the door, the guy says, come in, I come in. He stands up, he puts his arms out, he wants to hug me. He's my disciplinarian from high school. But not only that, but he's sober a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started talking to me, how you doing? I said, good, Father, how you doing? And he wants the 411, you know, like where you're going to meetings. I'm telling him, giving him the information. He said, who's your sponsor? I says, I don't have one. Because I'm a pretty bright dude. He knew that. He knew I was a sharp guy. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. And I asked my roommate to be my sponsor. God forbid, again, should I ever be questioned? Bobby, who's your sponsor? There he goes. The only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped into him in the meetings. He waved at me and said, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him, but I used to do it. I used to talk about him. I used to tell people, so you won't believe this guy. He wants me to do this. He wants me to do this. He's kind of weird. He didn't do nothing. He put the hand in AA out there. Not only did I slap it away, then I character assassinated the guy in the boat. I was just nuts. I wanted to eat my gun. So I'm 25 months sober. And I decided I'm going to go to one last meeting before I do this. And I go to this meeting, and Troubles is there. He's at this meeting. And at the end of the meeting, I go up to him. I said, Bobby, because he didn't like to be called Troubles, and he was a rough dude. He could be called whatever he wants. I said, Bobby, I said, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? He looked me dead in the eye. I said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years, and I'm sticking my chest out. I said, yeah, he kind of likes me. He says, I need to tell you, you're full of shit. That's not the answer I'm looking for. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. You're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment. You're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm talking to myself, who's he talking to? I'm sober 25 months. I'm selling the grapevines. I got it going on. What I did do, I said, okay, to myself, I said this, of course. So, but I looked him dead in the eye, I said, okay. Then he took me back to his house that night, and he kind of used some colorful language with me because that's what I needed to do because I was running circles. Like, my neighborhood at that time was getting gentrified, and the yuppies were coming in, and you know how they ruin everything, you know. So I'm running circles around them, but he knew how to talk straight to me, and that's what I needed. He took me back to his house that night, and he introduced me to the big book. He had, and again, some colorful language. He told me I didn't know anything. I should just shut up and listen to him. And we go through the first two steps. Then he says we're going to get on our knees and say a third step prayer, which really kind of made me nervous. But I did it because, again, there was a part of me knowing that I was safe with this man. I said the prayer with him, and then when we got up, he said, Bobby, the way we do a third step, we take paper and pen and we do a fourth step. I said, whoa. Easy does it. Let's keep this simple. Have I just called on me and just not drink, you know? And I know the slogans serve a purpose, but I was twisting them around to not do any work, you know? But I really don't want to do an inventory. I'm going to meetings and people say, doing the inventory, stirring stuff up, I feel like going out. Why want to eat my gun? You can't get no further out than that. So I did my inventory, no big deal. I mean, it took me a while, you know? Took me quite a while, to be honest. Pain's a real good motivator, you know, but I finally get done my inventory. I call my sponsor up. I say, Bobby, I'm going on a retreat this weekend. I'm going to do that fifth step with a priest. He said, Bobby, that's great. When you get done, stop by my house so you can do it with me. And you know, sometimes you're on your phone with your sponsor and you feel like, yeah, Dad, did you hear what I said? But before I said anything, he told me, he said, Bobby, I am your sponsor. The next two steps, 6 and 7, character defects. In order for me to help you with them, I need to have an idea what they are. Even though I have a good idea, and he hung up on me. The reason I wanted to do the fifth step with the priest was not to be spiritually enlightened. I got my inventory, all my resentment. I hate the church. I hate God. Right? It wasn't to be spiritually enlightened. In fact, the truth is, there were things in my inventory that I was embarrassed about, that I was afraid to tell my sponsor, for the fear that he would pass judgment on me, he would ridicule me, or even worse, he would betray the confidence what I was about to disclose to him, he would tell other people. That's why I want to do it with the priest, which kind of tell you that my fear list isn't quite done. I never did that fifth step with a priest, I did it with my sponsor, and none of those things have happened at all. He didn't pass judgment, he didn't ridicule me, to the best of my knowledge, he never told anybody else. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his experience with me, which took away the feeling of the terminal uniqueness in which I thought I had. See, he had also taken someone's life, and he had paid the price, he had gone to prison for that. And that's not why he asked him to be my sponsor. I asked him to be my sponsor because of what I saw in the neighborhood. It wasn't in the rooms of AA. He was a pretty rough dude, but you know what? He didn't use anything. He didn't have any profanity. And even though he had a lot of ink, he wore long sleeve shirts. Not that he was embarrassed, but he just wanted to carry himself in a different way. And he had a lot of women friends, not because he was a player, because he treated them with dignity and respect. This guy was really walking the walk in the neighborhood where it's tough to do it, you know? That's why he asked him to be my sponsor. And he had just helped me tremendously. Now, at this point, when I got done talking to him, I was about to leave. He said, yo, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. He said, no, you got to sit quietly for that 1 hour. And he lived by himself, and he had a quiet room set up, so I sat in his house. And it had to be longer than an hour, and I knew I did nod off, but he checked on me, wanted to make sure I did nod off. At this point, I'm sober 32, 33 months. I wish I'd tell you I did it sooner. It's not my experience. I'd be lying to you. But please don't wait. I was just nuts. Why I didn't pick up a drink for those first almost 3 years, I have no idea. But when I got done, it was a tremendous relief. Now, this may not sound like a lot to you, but for me, it was a tremendous relief. The screaming inside stopped. My head stopped racing. It was incredible relief. It really was. So we didn't burn my fourth step when I did my fifth step because he said I would need this for the rest of the steps, 6 and 7, character defects. I didn't know what these were before I did my inventory. I knew when I drank that I was a character. The truth was I did my inventory and I found out that I had no character whatsoever. I tell people I didn't have a spiritual awakening. I had a rude awakening. I had it in black and white. I thought highly of myself. You know, that's why we write it. You know, because up here I did no wrong, and here it was kind of ugly. You know, I thought I was the cool uncle, like my nephews and nieces liked me because you know I hooked them up, you know, birthday, Christmas, and things like that. The truth was, towards the end of my drinking, I was no longer welcome at family functions because they couldn't trust the way I would behave. I thought I was the greatest cop in the city, accommodations left and right. I was rides and going places. The truth was, I engaged in behavior that brought dishonor among my coworkers. I justified my behavior due to the type of work that I did. Whether I served with men and women who served in a narcotics unit who didn't do the same type of behavior I did, they served with integrity and honor, you know. It was tough to see this stuff in black and white, you know. And the sixth step for me was a prayer. But my sponsor told me, Bobby, you need to put legs on those prayers. I mean, I can be pray all day long. One of my character defects is patience. Sometimes I'm not the most patient guy. And I can pray all day long, God, help me be patient, help me be patient. But during the course of my day, should you cross my path, we have some sort of interaction, and you try my patience, and I lash out at you. Sarcasm. It's nothing but anger, also referred to as language of the Irish. But I lash out with you. It's sarcasm. That's all that is. It's anger. That, see, God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but it is a program of action, you know. So I had to become willing in the seventh step, and the seventh step was a prayer. So because I didn't burn my fourth step when I did my fifth step, when I got to my eighth step, most of my eighth step was done. Now I'm one of these guys, oh, I never harmed anybody but myself. That should have been a tip off. I never did my inventory, because once I got done my inventory, I found out I harmed everybody I came in contact with. And unfortunately for me, those closest to me were harmed the most. And I had to put more names down in there. And the ninth step, direct amends. And I'd like to share two quick experiences on the ninth step. I'm at this meeting in North Philadelphia. The Day by Day group meets at 11 in Rockland. This had to be in the early 90s. I'm sober probably about 2 or 3 years at this point. Maybe no. It had been 4 years because I wasn't doing the program. About 4 years. I see this guy. He walks down the steps. I have not seen this guy since the late 70s. I don't have him on my A-step list. Not for any reason. I just plain forgot. They say more will be revealed. As soon as he walked down the steps, it was revealed. When I drank, I used to like fighting big guys. I don't know why, I wasn't good at it, but I liked to do it anyway. We were in a bar one day, I had an exchange with this guy, and he would back down. And then one day, like the verbal taunts. You know, then I even slapped him open-handed, he didn't do nothing. And whenever I wanted to press anybody how tough or nuts I was, I would pick on this big guy. And I'm not a tough guy, I never was. And then one day I spat on him. The art of degradation of spitting on another human being, it doesn't get any lower than that. He walks down the steps. I recognize this guy right away. He does not recognize me. He sits in the second row. I can introduce. I stand up. I look him dead in the eye. I say, my name is Bobby Goyle. I'm an alcoholic. Now I need to take a quick moment here and tell you why I use my full name. I know these traditions. They're top secret. Even though this is a service conference, God forbid we even mention a concept. But these traditions, I mean, a lot of them are really misunderstood, and I don't know why, they're pretty straightforward, but nothing's more so misunderstood than this 11th tradition. I'll pass with the 7th, but the 11th is misunderstood too. All of a sudden, we get sober, it's like we join the mafia, right? Everyone gets a nickname. There's John the Brick, and Jimmy the Coat, and Bucktooth Mary, and Red Sweater Jerry, and Frank the Fox, and Mike the Monk, and Charlie Guitar, and the list goes on, right? I mean, everyone gets a nickname. I mean, God forbid everybody in my neighborhood knows I go to AA. My reputation should be tarnished somehow. Everybody in the neighborhood knows I'm drunk. There's those little telltale signs. They come outside to catch me. I'm urinating on their car. My girlfriend's rolled the clothes out the window. Everyone knows I'm a drunk, but, you know, God forbid, oh, AA, don't let people know. The 11th tradition is real clear. Personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. This is not a secret society. I mean, God forbid, 3 o'clock in the morning, you feel like drinking, you call information. Yeah, I'd like to have Jim Nicotes on them, please. Or you want to go visit one of these beloved old-timers in the hospital. Yeah, I'm here to see Frank the Fox. You know, come on, man. Dr. Bob and the Good Old-Timers is one of my favorite books. It actually, Dr. Bob said, when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that's a violation of the 11th tradition. He went on to say that anonymity is spiritually inspired and secrecy is fear inspired. This is not a secret society. However, press, radio, and films. That means you will never see my face, full face, clearly identified, followed by my full name, which is Robert Ignatius Benedict Coyle III, followed by the statement, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That would be a violation of the 11th tradition. People get all up in arms, they see a celebrity on television and the person say, I'm sober. That's not a violation. Although say so-and-so is in recovery. That's not a violation. It's a violation when they are clearly identified and then they claim to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the purpose of that is actually to protect the individual, not AA, you know. But whatever, off that soapbox, back to the meeting. I look this guy dead in the eye. I'm Bobby Coyle. I'm not walking any knots. See, I was told that making amends is much more than saying I'm sorry. Because for me, they're two words that don't mean squat. And like financial amends are easy. I go in my pocket, I pay you. If it's a great sum, I make some sort of arrangements with you. But what about the psychological damage or the emotional damage? How do I make amends for that? I was told that I sit down and have conversations with people, tell them what I did, as if they didn't know. But the most important thing, never engage in that behavior again. And so, but I thought the least I could do since it wasn't the grandstand, I figured if I publicly humiliated this guy, the least I could do is make amends to him publicly. And I told the group what I did to him. He got up out of his chair and he came up and he hugged me. It was an incredible experience. Now at the end of the meeting, I start talking to him. His name was Bob. I said, Bob, man, it's been years. I haven't seen you. How you doing? He said, Bobby, I'm sober. 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, get out of here. Now the arrogance creeps in. Because everybody in Philadelphia knows me. I'm not saying that they like me, but they know me. I'm involved, right? And I can't believe our paths never crossed. I said, man, what are you doing? I ain't seen you. How come I didn't know you're sober? And now I need to tell you, I live in South Philadelphia. This meeting is in North Philadelphia, and he lives in Roxborough, which is like considered like Northwest, right? Northwest Philadelphia. And I said, well, Bob, what brings you here? Because Philly is a city of neighborhoods. It's very parochial. It's very rare that you go outside your neighborhood for any number of reasons. We just don't do that. And so I said, what brings you here? He said, Bobby, I was slipping through the meeting directory, and for some reason, I just want to go to a different meeting. And for some reason, this meeting just jumped out at me. We have 1,600 meetings a week in the city. We're both at a meeting we have never been to before. And he said, for some reason, this meeting just jumped out at me. I am a firm believer that my God put that guy in my path and I could do two things. I could do what I did, or I could do what I always did, which is, when you have 8 siblings in a 10.5-year span, there is a very close resemblance. And people come up to me, hey, USOB, I remember you. I said, oh, no, I'm sorry, you got me confused. You're talking about my brother Brian or my brother Sean, not me. I had to make amends to my brothers, you know. So another experience on the 9th step, my home group for a while was the Stepping Stones group, Northeast Philadelphia. I was a business meeting on a Sunday morning. I made a motion, had a meeting for the better of AA because I made it. Unbelievable thing happened. My motion doesn't get seconded. I've never seen that happen. I've seen the craziest motions get passed for no other reason. I know he looks like an idiot. It doesn't have a chance to get passed, but I'll at least second it to make him feel good, you know. Now, there's a guy in the meeting, I mean, we're boys. I mean, we're from the same neighborhood, and there's certain rules in the neighborhood. Everyone knows what they are, right, wrong, or indifferent. You always got your boys back. Even if you went out of the neighborhood, he ran his mouth and he started a fight, you always had to cover his back. If you got beat up, you and him could discuss that later. You never dated anybody else's ex. You just don't do that. It's just slimy. You know, I don't care. I think you're cute. I'd like to take you out, but you went to Frankie's prom 20 years ago. I'm sorry. You just don't do that. It's a neighborhood thing. It's a loyalty thing. You just don't do certain things. Well, I'm making eye contact with this guy. Like, I'm going in fits. Like, he could see me. And Freddie, and he stares right through me. My motion doesn't get seconded. I can't believe it. It goes down in flames. I come to the meeting afterwards, there'd be 10, 20, 30 guys. They all say hi to me, including Fred. I would never talk to him again. He waved to me, hey, Bobby. And I'd look at him, and then I even give him the dirty look. I can't even just smile, you know. I'm at work one day, and my coworker comes up to me. He said, Bobby, Freddie Wheels is outside. I want to take care of some sort of business. My coworker was in the program. I peeked out the window. I saw him. I said, tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall. He can't do that here. A couple weeks later, that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, Freddie Wheels died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. As God is my judge, I cannot tell you what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. Here was a guy that was a friend of mine. But obviously, I certainly didn't act like a friend. He was put in my path many, many, many times. I can't tell you how many times he was put in my path. That's how many it was. And the moment that that co-worker told me, he's a Bobby because he always spoke so highly of you, I felt about yay big. And I've been praying for Freddie ever since. See, I thought that word in the 9th step was whenever possible. It's actually wherever. Whenever's time, wherever's place. For me, it's never the right time because I'm too busy easy doesn't it, you know? The 10th step is nothing but the 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I'm up here and tired, I do a 10th step every day. That's not true, but I'm pretty good. 4, 5, 6 times a week. Twice a week. Once a week. You know, and I'm one of these guys, well, if I'm not practicing these principles in my and all my fears, no one knows but me. That's not true either. Because when I'm not practicing these principles, I operate in nitwit mode. And when I operate in nitwit mode, should you cross my path, you too are affected. I remember a few years ago, it was my job to get the rolls for the group's anniversary, right? And when I drive, like sometimes I got like Tourette's, you know, and I just like flip, I curse, and things just happen. I probably shouldn't have said that. And sooner or later, you talk long enough, you're going to insult somebody. But I shouldn't do that. But I'm just an idiot behind the wheels at times, right? That's a character defect coming in. So somebody beeps and I just go off and flip and my veins probably stick out of my neck. So later that night I'm at the group's anniversary and Pete comes up. He had since passed away. Pete was sober 40 plus years and every group has a guy like Pete. It just exudes serenity, sparkles in his eyes, just a really good dude. And he comes up, he said, Bobby, can I talk to you afterwards? I said, yeah, Pete. See, I thought he was going to ask me for a ride home because some of our old timers, they don't get out at night and I think, you know, you should give him a ride home. I thought that's what he wants. So after the meeting, I said, yo, Pete, what's up? He said, I saw you earlier today over 3rd and Poplar. He said, I beeped and waved. And you waved back. And I was so embarrassed because he told me, like, with a twinkle, I said, oh, man, I flipped Pete off. I mean, first of all, you shouldn't flip anybody off, but let alone a guy like him. But he said it with a twinkle in his eye. He didn't do it at group level, didn't do it to embarrass me. But he pulled me, he called me on it, and he just did it in such a loving way, and which made me even feel even smaller. I said, man, which shows you I never got away with nothing. I always thought I did, never, you know. 11th step through prayer and meditation. I pray and meditate on a daily basis. I don't pray the way I was indoctrinated as a kid, and I was never introduced to meditation as a kid. Up to this point, I've been giving you my experience. I don't believe you should ever give your opinion from the podium, but if you do, you should qualify. So I'm about to give you my opinion. This is why I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is so successful, because you guys allow me the freedom to find a way to pray and meditate in which I am comfortable. If there were only one way to pray and meditate, I guarantee you would have a different speaker tonight. And so over the years, I tried a lot of different things, and I've found a way in which I am comfortable, and I do that on a regular basis. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening, I've had that spiritual awakening. No burning bushes, no lightning bolts, no voices from above. In fact, it's been a number of years since I heard any voices, and for that I'm truly grateful. But I had the change of attitude that our literature talks about. We tried to carry this message. Sometimes I got reminded about that word try. See, I went through my evangelical stage. I had my fireman's hat on. I had the big book with the highlight markers, color coordinated, and running around. This is the way to do it. This is the only way to do it. If you don't do it this way, you're going to get drunk. You know. The truth was, I was using the big book as a weapon. I wasn't using it as a tool. But the more important part of this is to practice these principles in all of our affairs. I'm only in NAA an hour and a half a day. What about the 22 and a half hours? What about the time in the work? What about the time on the street? What about the time in my neighborhood? You know, the time with my family, where you're supposed to do these things all the time. Listen, I make mistakes. I don't want to stand up here and give you the impression that I'm the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I invite you to come live with me for a week. See what type of guy that I am. But you know what? I know I'm not the guy that I was 23 years ago, and I like to think I'm not the guy that I was 3 years ago. I make mistakes. Making mistakes doesn't get me loaded. It's not learning from those mistakes, defending those mistakes, or even justifying those mistakes that will lead to the arrogance, that will lead to the drink. You know, I then got involved in service, and I learned about the traditions, and I love the traditions. The traditions are to the group, what the steps are to the individuals. And in just a few minutes left, especially this is like a conference put on by the area. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. And I love the fact that you read the I am responsible. I'm responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to always be there for that. I'm responsible. See, the preamble says my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. If I'm only staying sober and not helping out other alcoholics, that's half measures. And even says, half measures of all is nothing. It doesn't say half measures of all is something, half measures of all is a little, half measures of all is nothing. I got a job to help people. And my book tells me that's the guarantee for not getting drunk, for working with other alcoholics. 12-step work takes many different forms and fashions. Like the guys who put this conference on, those guys who get involved in the area, that's great. But not everyone has the time to get involved in that, you know? And my friend Billy on Friday morning, who did a beautiful job, he talked about service. And I believe strongly every person in this room has a gift. I mean, I know corrections aren't for everyone. It's very rewarding work, but some people don't want to do that. I mean, there's CPC. That's not PCP, that's CPC. Collaboration with professional community, where you take a professional student to an open AA meeting. So for one day when they're practicing their profession, whether they be a doctor, nurse, or a minister, they'll know how to make a referral. You know, some rewarding work, you know. And some of us may not have as much time as others, and so you could be a telephone volunteer, whatever it is. But you got to find what your gift is, you know. It's different than the person sitting next to you. But that's what we do. You know, it's an incredible way of life. And I'll finish up with this, just two quick stories. I was in Mexico about 20 years ago. I thought I could speak Spanish for all those years I worked in a barrio. Now, but my Spanish consisted of dame pistola, which means give me your gun. That was my Spanish, right? So I'm the only English-speaking person in this room. I'm thinking I'm speaking Spanish. These poor people looking at me figuring out what the hell I'm saying. So I switch over to English because I don't want to insult anybody, you know? And they still don't know what I was saying. And at the end of the meeting, they came up and they hugged me. And I could tell who the old-timer was by the serenity in their face. And I could tell who the new guy was by the pain in their face. They may not have understood, but you know what? They understood. Language of the heart. You know, it's an incredible way of life. What's it like today? I got a great life. You know, I'm still with the city, but I'm no longer a police officer. So for those who have warrants, you can relax. We had computers, so you got to take care of that stuff. Back in the day, we lost paperwork. That doesn't happen anymore. Take care of that stuff. So I just had 28 years of service with the city. I just celebrated 23 years of sobriety a couple weeks ago. Never married, no kids. However, I guess about a month and a half ago, I wound up getting engaged. I'm 50. Ain't no senior. Lovely young lady from Omaha. There she goes, friends of Edith, which is pretty neat, you know, and it's amazing. I was a runner. I was always a runner. But being an alcoholic, God forbid, we just jog. So I got into the Boston Marathon, of course, you know. And to do Boston, actually, you have to qualify. Or there's a couple lottery slots, but you got to qualify. So I'm actually training to do the Marine Corps Marathon. This is 1993. And I'm running 15 miles a day four times a week. I'm in great shape. And I'm 33. I'm sober, 6 years? It's pretty tough, you know. One day I trip. I'm not the most graceful guy. I actually wear a size 13. I trip, hurt my shoulder. It throws my stride off. I said, let me go get this checked out to get ready for the Marine Corps Marathon. I get diagnosed with lung cancer. It wasn't the trip from my fall. It was a tumor pressing against my lung. That was the pain in which I was experiencing. I never smoked in my life. I'm a little old reefer for a short period of time, but that doesn't count. But I can't believe it. So I went to go get a second opinion, and it got confirmed. And I was very involved in service, and I actually had to step down from my service position, not because I just couldn't serve anymore. I was just sick, and I thought the area would be better served. So then I bounced back. I have chemo, radiation. I go through the deal, and then I bounce back. And then I really get sick. And they eventually removed the lower left lobe of my lung. And then after I got out of the hospital, I was laid up. I couldn't even make meetings. I was just really, really sick there. Now, we had 1,600 meetings a week. No excuse not to make a meeting, but I couldn't make meetings. And people start coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're looking at a liar, a thief, and a cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people came to my house to carry the message. And I'm not talking about just my friends or sponsees or whatever. I'm talking about people that I may have met once or twice at the assembly. Or maybe friends, people I never even know who came with somebody else. Thank God for insurance and the city. But it was, without question, it was the prayers of AA that saved me. I bounced back. I've been fighting this for almost 14 years. I had just finished up another round of chemo right before Christmas. So in March, I had my first three-month checkup. And just this past Tuesday, I had my second three-month checkup. And I got the call yesterday, so things look pretty cool. And I called off till December to get my next checkup. Now, I've been up and down with my weight, I glow in the dark, things like that. The reason I bring this up, especially for the new people here tonight, when I first got diagnosed, and I swear to God, this, the very first thought popped in my mind, Bobby, people, chemotherapy, smoke pot. It's amazing. It's amazing how quickly the head plays with you. But I also, because I made regular attendance meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've seen some men and women go through some terrible things through no fault of their own, especially in this economy. I've had friends who've had some tough times in the last year or so through no fault of their own, and they get through it one day at a time. That's what God promises me. One day at a time, we can get through anything. Even though I made an excuse to go out and get loaded, I didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. Because I took some action in which I didn't believe in, I was able to clean up the records of my past. Anybody can walk through that door and say, hey, USOB, I remember you 23 years ago, and that's okay, I'm at peace. You know, it's just a wonderful way of life. That kid on the bicycle, what happened to him? You know the old saying, God takes care of drunks, fools, and children? Man, I hit the trifecta that day. That kid was not hurt seriously. I had an opportunity to make amends to him. I did not know him personally, but I knew his family. He was the same age as one of my younger brothers, and I had the opportunity to make amends to him. God forbid, should he have been hurt seriously, it probably would have changed the circumstances of the entire event, and I probably would not be here today. It's just a wonderful way of life. I'm going to finish with this. I grew up in a neighborhood that was a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood, you know. And most guys want to get join a trade. You got a union book, you know. And if you didn't have a record, you'd become a cop or a fireman. That was that type of neighborhood. And so let's say AA is almost the same way. So when you join a building trade, let's say you become an electrician. You go to school one day a week, and then you work 4 days a week. You're an apprentice, and at the end of 4 years, you become a journeyman. AA works the same way. You show up, you're a new person. You're an apprentice. You get yourself a sponsor. I always say these controversial remarks for the end. Make sure your sponsor has done the steps. If he or she has not done the steps, he or she has not, no business sponsoring you. How do you find out they did the steps? I know, it's a test. You ask them. You hear two things, yes or no. The person says yes, that's your person. He or she takes you under your wing. You become a journeyman. And you get yourself an apprentice. It's been working that way since June 10th of 1935 in Akron, Ohio. Why you need a dirt ball from South Philly to come here and tell you to do it any differently? It's a wonderful way of life. And again, thank you very much for the privilege. And it's always a privilege to participate.